Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. With me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. This week, we speak to Beth McCall, author of How to Come Alive Again, about living with a mental illness. And we ask, is it ever okay to have an affair?
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Now, do we all remember what happened with Ashley Madison? Nat, for anyone who does not know the Ashley Madison scandal, tell us a little bit about what Ashley Madison is and, well, tell us about what happened with them a few years ago.
So Ashley Madison is a married dating website. So if you are married, you can go onto Ashley Madison and add a profile to essentially have an affair. And a few years ago, unfortunately, they were hacked and the details of their members, so email addresses, names, contact numbers, were out in the open domain, which meant that you could search a database to find out if your other half was looking for another half. And there was also a series of MPs and celebrity names that came up. But it highlighted that there is a platform that's helping people cheat whilst married.
A growing platform. A growing platform, yeah. Because the news this week is they've reached the 60 million member mark and they've had more than 5.3 million new members in 2018 alone. That's a lot.
Yeah.
So I've got to put the question out there, ladies. Have you ever cheated on another half?
So at what point does it count?
I think if one has to ask.
No, so
I would say if either of you have a justifiable expectation that you are exclusive, and I would say that is you have spent more than 48 hours together.
So in that case, no, because we were never exclusive. Because remember my dating history, I have not actually been in a proper relationship, yeah. And I dated sort of like bad boys. So no. So I've dated two
people concurrently.
Yeah, exactly.
Good girl.
Yes. and we often talk about relationships and monogamy. And I am still in a place where I'm not entirely sure that is me. I don't believe there's one person forever and ever and ever. I believe there's someone that you love and you commit to them and you have a conversation about your desires and your wants. And it's highly plausible that you might meet someone in a scenario and you energetically connect and you might want to explore that. I right now am open enough to say I could be okay with that, and therefore I know I could be okay with an open relationship. But there are levels to it, and I think there are also levels to where you come. So if I was married to someone and, you know, either of us was exploring, I think that's fine. I don't think I could be in a relationship with a married man. In fact, I could not be in a relationship with a married man, i.e. he has someone else.
Yeah. Emma, what about you?
No, I've never cheated. I'm pretty much a monogamous kind of person, really. And I always used to think that I would. I feel like we don't have the tools to be monogamous. There is, I think there is a challenge in marriages, and I have a lot of conversations with my girlfriends in terms of there's sort of a misunderstanding of what each other needs to, you know, sustain a really good sex life and to be interested in sex and to still be interested in, you know, flirting and enjoying your partner for 10, 20 years. That is an art. You need skills about with that. And when I don't think we get taught that. So I think the immediate thing is I'm not, you know, for men, the conversations I've had with men who've cheated on their wives, they'll be like, I love my wife, I love my family, but I'm just not getting enough sex. But then you have to go, well, hang on a minute. Like, why are you not having this dialogue with your wife? Why are you not seeking ways that the two of you, because everybody, most people enjoy sex or should be enjoying sex. So I feel like we're not taught that. We don't know how to have the conversation. But, you know, affairs are unavailable people. Like, I don't know why you would want to be with an unavailable person. You can't possibly have a really fulfilling relationship with somebody who's not available. You can certainly have more sex. And maybe that's just what people want.
So I have never cheated on anyone. But I did come very close to having a relationship with somebody who was, to all intents and purposes, married. And I hesitate to say that because I know that Emma's mum listens to this show and I don't want Wendy Sexton to have a bad opinion of me.
You're corrupting me.
Sorry, Wendy. but I met somebody a while ago on a dating app and we got talking and we got on really well. And we kept trying to meet up and he kept having last minute emergencies and it really wasn't going anywhere. And I eventually did a bit of Googling of him and found out that he was in a very serious long-term committed relationship. And so I sort of shut it down. I was like, absolutely not. And then about 6 months later, he popped up again. And I think I was having a day where I was feeling a bit lonely. And so then we sort of started talking again. And this went on and on and on. It kept happening. And I always felt that I was somebody who was very strong, that I would never breach the sisterhood like that, that I would never go after somebody else's man, in quotes, I would never go after somebody who was in a relationship. And I found myself being drawn into this situation where I was hoping that I could make a relationship with this guy, and that meant that there was a level of deception that maybe I wasn't partaking in, but I was certainly aware that he was partaking into his girlfriend. And it made me very aware that we tend to be black and white about this subject. And actually, there but really, for the grace of God, go most of us, because
but what isn't black or white is emotion.
Yeah.
And that is a thing that my mind is open to.
Yeah.
That in any given moment, things happen. And I, hand on heart, cannot say that there is, if I got married tomorrow, that I couldn't bump into someone that I was emotionally or sexually attracted to and would want to explore that. And therefore, it's better for me personally to be honest with myself than to lie.
But that's very different to joining up a site like Ashley Madison, where you are
actively
cheating and you are being dishonest.
Well, we are lucky enough to have Paul Keeble, Chief Strategy Officer for the Ashley Madison app, on the phone. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. Good evening, ladies.
Hi there. So I hope you've heard how we feel. We're sort of, we feel like we couldn't do it, and yet we wonder if maybe we would do it. We don't know. How is the site growing so fast? Are there just millions of unhappily married people out there?
Well, I think that's a bit of a misnomer, the idea that they're all unhappily married. There's clearly an aspect of their marriage that is fundamentally flawed or lacking in, you know, happiness. But that doesn't mean they don't love their wives or their husbands. They're very much, what we hear from our members is that they are very happy, generally speaking, but there's an element that they're missing. And instead of choosing the pathway of divorce and, you know, breaking up the whole family, they're looking at infidelity as a new pathway to fulfill the one need that's missing and maintain the family unit. And what we're finding through that is that people are, in essence, building marriages and saving marriages through infidelity.
But don't you think we should be teaching them skills to maintain desire rather than actually just giving them an option to go and cheat on their partners?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that would be a perfect world. But the reality is, you know, we live in a world where one partner can say to the other, you know, 15, 20 years into the relationship and say, I'm no longer, you know, desiring an intimate relationship. I have that right. And we all acknowledge that is absolutely that one individual's right. But to the other partner, what is their option? They can have every discussion they want. But if their wife or their husband says that the bedroom is no longer part of our relationship, what are they left to do? That doesn't mean they don't love their spouse any longer. And all the tools in the world won't help us mitigate the loss of that.
Paul, do you not also think there's something about the times that we're in and sex with someone outside of, you know, the everyday is also a form of escapism? And more people are in a place where they need to escape from the day to day, and sex and sexual pleasure and almost doing something wrong is mm-hmm. is part of what they're looking for.
The thrill.
I think there's an element to that, but I think, you know, some of the myths that we try to expose about why people choose this pathway is that it's women who usually choose infidelity for the purposes of physical intimacy, very sexual based. We have research from Dr. Alicia Walker from the University of Missouri that showed that these women were straying to stay in their marriages, whereas the men were actually looking for more of an emotional connection. The physical aspect was secondary to their needs. They were looking to be desired, to feel mm-hmm. that they were still wanted and desirable. The physical aspect was part of it, but that wasn't the primary reason.
I can definitely, I was about to say empathize with that. I don't know why.
That's interesting because we tend to assume that men are more sexual creatures and therefore more likely to treat. And yet what else was in your research, Paul, is that the numbers of men and women signing up is pretty much equal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the UK, in fact, it's actually in 2018, we saw 1.08 women sign up for every one active paid male. So roughly the same, but just a slight increase in female. We've seen a lot of other research outside of Ashley Madison show that very same sort of stat. Wednesday Martin, I'm not sure if you're familiar mm-hmm. with her in her book, Untrue, she's been talking a lot about the myths related to women and sexuality and specifically around infidelity. There's been a 40% increase in female infidelity since the 90s, and men have been relatively flat.
What age group are predominantly on your site, Paul?
Well, it's obviously going to skew a little bit slightly older. Our main constituency is roughly 35 to 45, but what you are seeing is more people who are looking at life stages, mm-hmm. you know, people who hit what we call the first bump effect is usually where we see the first instance of infidelity. That's what our members tell us.
What is the first bump?
Pregnancy shows up. When pregnancy shows up, because you move from a honeymoon relationship between you and your spouse, it's very much just the two of you, and you add that dynamic of a child, and it fundamentally changes a relationship, and people both on sides of the relationship will change how they view one another.
Interesting. I also heard as well that there's something around hormones as well, because as men get older, their testosterone drops, but in women it rises. So is your research done anything around the hormones?
We haven't done anything along that, but if you go back to what I said about why women cheat versus why men, it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know, men going through andropause, you know, will be looking for more of that emotional, psychological connection, where women who are increasing their, you know, physical desires through hormones are looking more for a physical connection.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so you've now completely warmed me over to the fact that, I mean, this site just needs to be there to allow women to explore their every desire. I'm like, here come the girls.
It goes back to some of the comments you were making earlier. You know, what we want and what we do with Ashley Madison more than anything is help people have successful affairs that are not discovered. And the first way to do that is don't do it in the office place. Huh? Don't do it on traditional singles dating
this
apps.
Is true.
Find Fair a partner enough. Who's also married, and neither one is going to want to risk getting caught.
Mm. Do you know how many people end up leaving their other half, Paul?
I don't have, you know, any stats that, because obviously not everyone's going to report the outcomes. You know, I've heard some amazing stories where we've had people leave their spouses, marry their partner, and then yet continue both of them on Ashley Madison in a more of a open marriage because they've realized the constraints of monogamy don't fit their lifestyle.
Mm. Interesting. And what would for you, give us your top tip if you want to be a successful adulterer?
Asking for a friend.
So, as I said... beyond signing up to Ashley Madison, you know, don't do it at the workplace. Don't do it within your social circles. Find somebody who has equal risk, what we call mutually assured destruction. Mm-hmm. If I'm married, I don't want to be caught. If I'm having an affair with someone who's not familiar with my family, not familiar with my colleagues, she's unlikely to want to be caught as well. And so those elements, you know, are going to lead to a greater likelihood of having a successful affair.
Actually, Paul, can I ask a quick question? Is your site just heterosexual, or is it also gay, bisexual?
We have everything. So you can sign up, you know, as a male seeking female or a male seeking male. So we have all elements of that. And, you know, we're clearly, you know, starting to see and talk a lot more about, you know, what's going to happen in the gay, lesbian, transgender world as more and more same-sex marriages are accepted and become legal. You know, in Canada, where we're based, it's been around for, I think, 20 years, so we're kind of used to it. But it's only recently become legal in a lot of other countries. And so that constituency is going to start moving up the chains, not just within our ecosystem, but within the whole world of infidelity, I think.
Amazing.
So really quickly, I mean, do you think this is going to save marriages in the long term?
I think more people understand what infidelity really is about, mm-hmm. and have real conversations, I think, yes, it can benefit marriages. But you have to have the real conversations first, because here's the quickest point I can make. You get married, you talk about all the things you want to do, but nobody ever has a hard discussion about what actually constitutes cheating. Yes, sleeping with someone else is cheating. What happens if I just go have lunch with somebody? Is that cheating? Mm. Those levels are where all the differences are made, and those discussions should be happening.
Brilliant, Paul. Thank you so much. Paul Keeble, Chief Strategy Officer for the Ashley Madison app. We've just learned how to become successful adulterers, ladies. That's going to stand us in good stead in later life.
I'll be bothered.
The Fempire strikes back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Now, if you are like the majority of people in the UK, at some point you will have had a moment where you've wondered if life was really going as well as you thought it should be, and if in fact it wasn't just all a little bit too much. Mental illness is on the rise in young people, and suicide is now the leading cause of death among young people aged 20 to 34 in the UK. Beth McCall, author of How to Come Alive Again, is a woman who has decided to try and tackle mental health in a, I'm going to say, Beth, a pretty straightforward, down-the-line manner.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. Anyway, that's definitely what I wanted to do when I wrote the book.
So you said the book is a guide to living with mental illness from somebody who's been there and done that. Tell us a little bit about your story.
So, I mean, mental health-wise, I think it's always been there. Mm-hmm. When I was a teenager, when I was a young person, it was always there. I certainly wasn't willing to admit that to myself or anyone else for a very long time. But I was kind of anxious. I was depressed. I wasn't a happy person a lot of the time, despite maybe presenting that way. And it wasn't until I got to university and I had an amazing first term and then really crashed the second term that I thought I'm going to have to tell someone about this. And it was, I guess that was maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that I said to someone, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling depressed. I think this isn't just me being a teenager, a young person. Mm-hmm. I think there's something really wrong. So that was my journey to that very first step where I said, something's the matter.
And what was it like when you actually admitted that? How did it feel?
It was an odd thing. I didn't want to do it at all. I was still in the mindset of, you know, I can deal with this myself and it's not real and it's probably me inflating in my head, and I should just, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit of a baby, I'm being weak, and people have really have these problems, and I'm, you know, I'm just a teenager. So it was very scary, and the first time I opened up, unfortunately, I didn't have a great experience, which is something I talk about in the book. I wasn't taken seriously by the GP, who said, well, you're young and this is probably hormonal, maybe just try and get a bit more sleep. And it took another really difficult couple of months before I went back, saw another doctor and was actually listened to. And they said, yeah, it does sound like your mental health is suffering here. Let's get you some help.
And in the book, you basically talk through the ways that people can help themselves and how to manage that. When you were researching it, kind of what were the areas that you were like, oh, I'm really clear, this is an easy one, I'm going to put in the book? And what was the stuff that you were like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know this was here and I need to really need to learn about it?
So the DBT and CBT stuff I talk in detail about. That's
for
a really
anyone who's not clear on the acronyms, tell us.
So there's cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, which are kind of quite similar ones, which there's a lot of workbooks. It's often the first port of call for a GP or a professional to say, these are things you can do at home. And you know, that's what I talk about in the book. And I'm clear that these are someone else's ideas and this is how they've helped me. And those are really accessible. There are some amazing workbooks online and free websites. So that was quite an easy one. And mindfulness as well, that's really in the public domain now. So these ones are really easy ones. I know that people would have maybe heard of them, or a quick Google search, you know, would help them out. The more difficult stuff, I think, was the medication bit. Definitely, I had to really deep dive and do some serious research about that, because, you know, it was kind of scientific and medical. And despite I've taken a lot of different antidepressants and antipsychotics, so I knew from personal experience, but there was so much that I didn't know, and these kind of long intimidating names of medications. So that was where I really put the research, I think.
Because there was a recent news report, wasn't there, that antidepressants being prescribed had gone up by 50%.
I and there's a really difficult conversation that we don't know how to have yet about, one, we need to destigmatize mental health drugs and medications, while at the same time being really honest about the fact that they are, in a lot of cases, prescribed to young people who maybe don't want or need them, in place of what they would need if the funding was there and if there were the resources. They wouldn't be prescribed a medication and sent on their way. They would, you know, first you would have therapy or you'd go and see a specialist. But it's a scary thing. It definitely is.
Yeah, because the thing that concerns me about the tablets is whilst they immediately give you the relief from mental health, which can be really important, I worry that it stops people from developing the skills to help them manage their mental health. If, you know, and there's different, you know, the scale of mental health support is quite vast, but I do feel, you know, I've got friends who've gone on antidepressants, and whilst they've immediately felt better, and I've looked at them and gone, wow, you've got to the place that's taken me sort of, you know, 10 years of reading, therapy, working on myself, and you've got there instantly, I can't help but think that actually now, when you take those pills, are you still going to be able to feel the way you're feeling? Are you going to have the skills to maintain feeling good and looking after your mental health?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really valid point. The first few times I went on antidepressants and did, you know, I had some great successes with them, and then would come off them or whatever. And I realized that without them, I didn't know how to deal with things. I didn't have any of these kind of cognitive skills to manage my emotional distress and manage relationships and my moods. You know, if they're going up and down, I need ways aside from the medications to deal with them. So I think that's something I talk about in the book, is building this resilience and doing all of the other work, because what mental health medications do in the best circumstances is give you that little bit of peace and space to then feel better enough to then seek out the other support that you need, and, you know, do the learning that you need to do.
And so I personally love the book, and I learned a lot, so I haven't read it all, but flicking through, and the chapter breakdown is perfect, because you can jump in at something that sticks out to you, and disassociation was something that stuck out to me, because I'd never heard of the term before and didn't really understand it, and reading it I was like, I have that.
Yeah,
there have been loads of times where
where you're
there but not there, or you feel like you're watching yourself, or certain you see things and it doesn't feel real, and I often get it at very specific places where I know I'm walking, but everything around me almost feels like not a cartoon but just a really weird environment, and it's sort of disconcerting and puts you on edge and on ease, but then something, you know, that snapback's like, no, but you are obviously walking across a bridge right now, so keep going. So reading that, I was like, okay, that makes sense. And last weekend, I stayed in bed I could not get out of bed. I deliveroo'd to my bed. I mean, if I could have let the delivery man up the stairs into my bedroom to give me the food.
Open the window and just chuck it in.
Basically. And I couldn't do anything. And so reading through it, and that process of thinking, okay, this makes sense. And then connecting the dots between that and self-harm. So I immediately flicked to self-harm, because we talk about it a lot on the show, and some people say that drinking red wine is self-harm. I'm like, one glass is not self-harm. One good glass is not self-harm. If it's Echo Falls, maybe. And so this is a really roundabout way of saying that I think you've broken it down beautifully so that there's something for everyone to just connect back to the fact it happens to us all in very different ways at different times.
That's what I think. I wanted it to be something that anyone can pick up and find something in, whether it's someone who has no real history or someone whose friend has just mentioned to them out of the blue, you know, I have depression, and they think, oh God, where do I start with this? I wanted it to be very accessible, and I know a lot of the information is readily available online, but I wanted to write it in and put it in one place and say it in a way that was not intimidating, not patronizing, and that was, you know, you can open up the book anywhere. It's not a linear thing. Mm-hmm. There's different sections for different things. It kind of builds into, there's one section which is maybe the heavier stuff. It's suicide, self-harm, the real low stuff. But apart, you can open it anywhere and just short paragraphs.
Yeah, it's nice how you've got the journey, haven't you? You've got like glimmer, sunrise, eclipse, which is, you know, there are those different stages on your mental health and whether you're happy, sad.
We try to organise it in a way that kind of ends on a positive, and it, you know, it takes you on that journey of, okay, I'm finding out that I'm mentally ill. What is the very basic stuff like antidepressants? How do I talk to a doctor for the first time ever? Into the, all right, I'm seeing a therapist. What should I expect? What should they do and what should they definitely not do? And then on to, you know, suicide, self-harm, the things that we don't know how to talk about. It's not pleasant to read, but it's also important. And then at the end, hopefully finishing off on a point, a hopeful point, I hope anyway.
We're going to keep talking to Beth all about her book, How to Come Alive Again.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We are talking to author Beth McCall all about her new book, How to Come Alive Again, A Guide to Killing Your Monsters. Beth, the book is aimed, am I right to say the book's aimed mainly kind of at a university age student?
I mean, when we were sort of promoting the book, we were saying, all right, maybe 16 to 35, but I know a lot of the writing is entry level stuff. So possibly it will be best received by someone who's maybe an 18-year-old to 25, but it's really just anyone.
Do you think that why is that age group in particular having a bit of a mental health crisis right now?
I know for me that was my real kind of reckoning with mental health, because there was less accountability for self-care. You know, I went off to university and my parents weren't there, and it was, you know, it was new friends. So it was no one that I had a, you know, real rapport with who knew my history. And if I didn't get up and go to university, if I didn't eat right, if I drank too much, there was no one to say, hey, hang on, is this okay? Are you okay? And I certainly wasn't doing that for myself. So I think it's just this freedom, and it's this wide open space where things drop off very easily, and you know, you're not looking after yourself, and it's, you drink too much, and for some people that's absolutely fine. But for other people, that hangover is going to be an anxiety trigger. It's going to mess you up for days and days on days. Maybe you're trying drugs for the first time. Maybe you're, you know, it's overwhelming, I think. I think that's why.
Also, you talk in the book about relationships and how, I guess, how do we manage relationships when we are potentially not at our best mentally, because we have, I definitely have a thing where I feel like I have to, if I'm in a relationship with someone, I have to turn up as my best. How do we manage the fact that sometimes we're not? And also sometimes one of the causes of that is the relationship.
It's a tricky one. It's a tricky one for me especially. I have reached a point in my life where I realise, okay, I need to do the serious work on myself before I get into another serious long-term relationship. But I also know people who are mentally ill and they're in relationships and they're managing it by having this constant open dialogue. And I think you both have to be in a place where you aren't, you know, crappy about mental health. You understand what it is and you understand that it's, you know, not anyone's fault, and you understand what behaviours come along with it. But you also have to be super, super accountable and say, you know, some days I'm not going to be able to show up for anyone, let alone myself, not you. And if you can deal with that, you know, we can have this partnership. But if not, you have to maybe go it alone in a way, and which sounds kind of depressing. But at the moment, I'm really embracing it as I'm going to do this work. I'm going to love my friends. I'm going to see where I'm at, and I'm going to give myself 6 months off. And then maybe, you know, I can have that again.
So I was, again, flicking through. I think it's really important to say lots of people can function perfectly fine with depression. And everyone has mental ill health, and everyone, you know, it's basically a swing.
Yeah, we all have physical health, we all have mental health.
So how do you go on a journey of helping to normalise it? The book is the first bit of it. Talking about it is another part. But what else do you think we need to do within society? But also, you know, making the dimensions of it normal. So in here you reference BPD, which is borderline personality disorder. I definitely have that. And it's fine. But if I said that to a normal person in a pub, maybe they might go, oh, and there's a lot of connotation. So how do we mainstream it? So it's just like, oh, okay, this is as normal as anything else we might talk about.
So what I talk about it all the time. I'll talk about it to anyone who will listen. I tweet about it, you know, but there's only so much that I can do with that. We have to look at the way we present it in media. So obviously with BPD, it's famously really, really misrepresented in films and TV shows. It's, you know, it's really stigmatizing. So we have to, you know, talk to the people who create this content and try and put forward things that aren't stigmatizing, that are fair. You know, I think
have you watched My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
Just about to say that. Yes, yeah. Which just finished, and I thought it was just fantastic, and I know a lot of people really champion it. Hopefully it will change things.
Brilliant representation of BPD in media, because for a start, for the whole of the first series, they don't talk about the fact that's what she's got. So you just see her behavior and you're like,
is it a reality show or a...
No, it's a
it's like a musical, it's comedy, like a musical, it's fantastic
sitcom, I guess. So you just see her behavior, and she's seen in this term as the crazy ex-girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And then in the kind of second series, when she gets diagnosed and she suddenly goes back, and you see her putting all her behavior in the context of what this mental illness means for her. And it's a complete rewrite of how we see both women and our, in quotes, emotional behavior, and also how we see BPD as shown on screen. So it's My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, very worth watching.
Yeah, would recommend.
Also great songs.
It's just brilliant, really sing along. Yes, and it's, so we start with that, we start with the way we talk about it. You know, we can all do what we can do. It's exhausting to feel like, okay, this is my task, I've got to address, you know, how we speak about this on a kind of cultural, social level. But what we can all do is talk to the friends and family that we're comfortable opening up with and calling them on the things that they say when it is stigmatizing, when it is unfair. I know it's, you know, it's one person, but actually that does make a difference. I think,
what do you think are some of the ways that we are going to treat mental health differently in the future because we've been having these conversations? So for right now, I feel like the big one is that we can't talk about it at work, because we fear that if we say, actually I need to take a mental health day, you know, all hell is going to break loose and everyone's going to suddenly be watching you the whole time, expecting you to crack and fall apart any minute. Do you think that that's going to change? Do you think in other ways it will change how our society behaves?
I mean, I would really hope that it does, but I know that a lot of big companies will pay a lot of lip service to, hey, we're really friendly and we really understand mental health. But actually in practice, it doesn't work out like that. And more I know that what people are doing is just being more kind of communally minded and kind of finding an ally in work or in university and saying, look, if I have to do this, will you have my back? Rather than it being a structural thing. But I am hoping that there are changes in these things. I talk to a lot of friends because I'm self-employed at the moment. But in the past, have never, ever felt that I could be open with an employer about my mental health. It's, you know, it was just never, I knew that I would be penalised for it. And I hope that we are going in that direction. But it's difficult to see that some days, I know.
In the book, you talk about strategies for getting through a bad day. If somebody is listening to this and they're going through a bad day, what are some of the things that you recommend?
So first off, I think you just have to shrink that expectation of, I'm going to achieve something big today. You have to just cut that away and say, you know, what I'm going to do today is make it from one end to the other. You know, I can do it. I can cry. I can really freak out and have a bad one. But if I make it from one end to the other, I'm here and I'm okay. Try and do these basic things. Try and drink enough water. Try and have some fresh air. Try and brush your teeth or have a shower or a wash or even just straighten up the bed and clear all the clutter out. And, you know, try and make yourself as physically comfortable, because a bad day, you can try and reckon with it, but sometimes it's just going to be a lot bigger than you, and that is more than okay. Mm.
Can you tell us a bit about, you've got a section here about bad self-care, because I feel like, you know, we talk about mindfulness and we talk about self-care, but, you know, really a lot of the self-care that goes around is like, have a bath with some candles, and I'm like, I just don't think that's self-care. So can you talk about what is bad self-care?
So for me, I think bad self-care is... So good self-care, I think, is something which takes care of me in the moment and in the future, doesn't put my wellness or my recovery in any jeopardy, and, you know, isn't physically harmful, or, you know, it's none of these things. So I think bad self-care is something which is avoidant. So I think, you know, if I would say, well, self-care is having a bath, and I have a bath in the middle of the day when I'm supposed to be doing work or I'm supposed to be somewhere, that's not good. Or if I kind of overindulge in, I drink too much and then feel really bad the next day, I can say, oh, that was, you know, it's fine, I'm human, I can do that. But I can't label it self-care and for it to be correct. I have to be honest with myself about, if it has the effect going forward that I kind of have a rough day because of it, it's not self-care.
So it was the first thing I flicked to, and it's that referencing if you've been inside in bed for 4 days, the first day because you need it if you're tired, fine. The second day, by day four, if you I think you said dried tomato ketchup in your hair. I was like, I don't know what you were eating to have dried tomato your hair. Maybe on my shirt, I'm not so sure about that, but it is that sort of thing. And I think we justify it to ourselves because we start off by saying we need it, but then there's that line between needing it and then letting, as I think your words, you know, everything's crumbling around you, or going to goo. Or so
I always remember having that exact moment when I woke up at like 2 p.m. in the afternoon. It was a beautiful sunny day. I could see the sunshine coming through my curtains, and I'd been in bed all day, and I woke up and my laptop was on Netflix, and it was showing like season 12 episode 257 of Criminal Minds, and I was just surrounded by empty biscuit packets, and I was like, and now we need to change something.
Yeah. Like, it's morally, it's fine to do, but when it makes you feel a bit bad, you think, okay, we're going to adjust slightly.
We've done this long enough now.
But there is a line, right? And so this is the thing about the spectrum. There will be some people that are tired and burnt out, and therefore they need to just sit still and engage with something that is entertainment and eat their favourite snack. But it's the line at which it becomes excessive. And I think this is the important bit of the conversation for me. How do we enable people to see what is okay and what you need, and what is that line of there is potentially a problem here? And we have this conversation about lots of things, whether that's people exercising excessively. Lots of people like, but, you know, but I'm really, really fit. But there's also a line where it's addictive. And people say, you know, if you're cancelling social engagements or you don't want to go out because you have to go to the gym, that's the flip side. And so it's recognising that something that you term to yourself to be good, when it then flips into a behavior, the word's not deviant, but when
is it self-harm, not self-care?
It's detrimental to you overall. And I think it's fine to, you know, say, all right, I'm doing this because I have depression, I have anxiety, and you don't need to moralize and say, oh god, I shouldn't, and it's awful. You can say, this is why I'm doing it, and I don't want to be doing it long term, but I am doing it because of the depression. It is problematic, I think, when you're saying, I'm just looking after myself, everything's fine, and there's seven missed calls and your work's late and you haven't been outside, you don't feel great, but you're in some... I've been in that denial space so, so many times. I know what it feels like. It's very easy to get there, and it takes some real grit to then gently guide yourself back into the light and back into a routine. It's hard work. It is difficult.
The tipping point.
Yeah, that's it.
Beth, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about
this joy.
How to Come Alive Again is out now.
It is. It's out. It's been out since last Thursday. It's on Amazon. It's on Waterstones. It's in the wild.
All good bookshops. As they say, it's a guide to killing your monsters. We love it. We thoroughly recommend it. Thank you so much for coming in, Beth. 1, 2, 3, 4. This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour, HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.